This is the Nature of Cities podcast. This is the Nature of Cities, a podcast about cities as ecosystems of people, nature, and infrastructure. We believe that better cities are built for and by people with livability, resilience, sustainability, and justice as the principal drivers of design. Episode 6, Citizen Science and the Flint, Michigan Water Crisis, produced by Philip Silva.
Millions of people living in cities throughout the United States put their faith in government scientists and engineers every time they take a drink of water from the kitchen sink. We expect that someone with authority out there on the other end of the pipe has taken every precaution necessary to ensure that the water we use to cook and clean and quench our thirst is itself clean and safe. Yet that daily ritual of implicit trust has been put to the test with recent revelations about dangerous levels of lead in the municipal water supply in the city of Flint, Michigan, a city that was once a thriving industrial powerhouse in the Midwestern United States, but saw a precipitous drop in manufacturing jobs throughout the second half of the 20th century. For decades, Flint paid to tap into the municipal water system in nearby Detroit to service its population of roughly 100,000 residents. Then, in April of 2014, in an effort to save money in a Rust Belt city that is perpetually strapped for cash, officials in Flint opted to start drawing water directly from the Flint River. It wasn't long before residents of Flint started complaining that something was just not right with the murky, smelly water flowing from their taps. Government officials repeatedly reassured the public that the city's water was fine, but Leanne Walters wasn't buying it. The 37-year-old Flint resident and mother of four had seen her family's health deteriorate in the months following the city's switch to Flint River water, with ailments that included hair loss, rashes, and a bout of abdominal pain that landed her teenage son in the emergency room.
In December of 2014, after one of my children had been out of school for a month, really sick, our water came through our tap brown for the first time. So at that point, it was like, what is going on? Like, that's not normal. We were all losing our hair. We were dealing with the rashes, unexplained headaches, dizziness. You know, I had some issues with my blood pressure. I mean, it was crazy.
According to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, there are no safe levels of lead in drinking water. But the federal agency does set a maximum acceptable amount of lead at just 15 parts per billion. If regular testing in a city's town or water supply shows any more than 15 parts per billion on average, local officials are legally required to take more aggressive action to get the lead out of their water.
I had to, like, fight with the city and get multiple doctor's notes for them to come in and make my house a priority.
When a worker in Flint came around to test the water flowing from Leanne's tap, one of the samples he collected contained nearly 400 parts per billion of lead, well above the EPA standard. City officials advised the family to stop using their tap water, but continued to insist that lead was not a citywide problem in Flint's water supply. And then nothing else really happened. Officials continued to test for lead throughout the city, teaching homeowners to, quote, pre-flush their water lines before sending workers out to collect samples. Over and over, officials pointed to the results of their tests to claim that Flint's water was safe.
At that point, I went down to the utility director's office, and one of the workers were in there, and they decided they were going to shut off my water and hook me up to a garden hose to my neighbor's home, and that we were told it was going to be for 4 or 5 days at the most. And it winds up being just over 5 weeks.
Dissatisfied with her city's response to the problem, Leanne leapfrogged local authorities. With some help from a mid-level official in a regional office of the EPA, she connected with Professor Mark Edwards in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Virginia Tech, some 500 miles and 3 states away from Flint. With help from Edwards and his lab, Leanne and her neighbors would end up exposing an environmental injustice of such enormous consequence that officials in multiple levels of government have resigned, and the issue has become a regular talking point for candidates in this year's presidential primaries. It turns out that pre-flushing is not a standard step in testing for lead in a municipal water supply. In fact, an EPA guideline explicitly tells regulators, quote, you want to collect a sample which has been in contact with the distribution system pipes for at least 6 hours. It's no surprise, then, that when Professor Edwards and members of his lab worked with Leanne to retest her water, this time without pre-flushing the pipes, the amount of lead they found skyrocketed.
Now, the testing in Leanne's home, of 30 samples that we looked at, the average was 2,000.
That's Siddhartha Roy, a graduate student working with Professor Edwards on what has come to be called the Flint Water Study at Virginia Tech. Working with the American Civil Liberties Union in Michigan, the Flint Water Study team would go on to uncover an alleged litany of sloppy testing procedures in what appear to be efforts by city water officials to purposefully hide the extent of the problem by testing for lead in parts of the city where it would least likely show up.
It all changed, I think, when ACLU of Michigan and we filed Freedom of Information Act to look at their data and actually see, what they were claiming. So what we found just blew our mind. The city sampling that they did, and it's on the website, the listeners can look at it. The original report card that they had actually sampled 71 homes, many of which had plastic plumbing. And later they even confessed in a video that they did not know where the lead pipes are. Fine, okay. But here's where things got even murkier. Out of the 71 samples that they got, Flint was indeed failing the lead and copper rule, even when they had sampled homes with even plastic plumbing, but the others, many of them were worse. And then they dropped 2 data points.
It quickly became apparent to the Flint Water Study team that an independent round of testing would be required to determine just how badly contaminated the city's water supply had become. Not just from Leanne's home, according to Siddhartha Roy, but from a statistically valid collection of random samples taken throughout Flint.
We decided that a comprehensive sampling would require participation of the entire city.
But how would grad students and their undergraduate assistants, working in a lab hundreds of miles from Flint, get their hands on enough reliable samples to counter the city's claims that everything was all right?
There's a few types of data that commonly require these academic-public partnerships. There's a research need to have it over large geographic areas, or over long time scales, or rare observations where you need a lot of eyes looking out for something. Or, in this case, observations or samples from residential areas or private homes.
That's Karen Cooper, the assistant director of the Biodiversity Research Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, and an expert on partnerships between scientists and concerned citizens.
I mean, it's funny because a lot of times people think that the most difficult research to do is like to go into remote field sites and pristine wilderness. But no, actually, the most difficult to sample areas, and hence the most difficult to study areas, are really homes. And so the only way to do it is collaborations between scientists and the public. And that is citizen science.
Little did Leanne know that in reaching out to scientists at Virginia Tech, she would end up becoming a researcher herself. A citizen scientist, to use Karen Cooper's phrase.
Citizen science has been around for a really long time in environmental justice issues. And what has generally been seen is that a lot of times when communities try to be heard about potential environmental problems or what they're being exposed to that's environmentally hazardous, they're not heard until they adopt citizen science methods and start to collect some data and really can put some quantitative numbers to what's happening. And for whatever reason, that often is really effective in finally getting a voice and like a seat at the table and to get people to sit up and listen and say, oh, yes, there's actually is a problem here.
And that's exactly how it went down in Flint, according to Leanne Walters.
We had to figure out a way to be heard, and we needed to prove it. And the only way to prove it was with the science. So for us, this was it. Like, if this didn't work, we didn't know where else to go or what else to do.
In order to launch its own independent investigation, the Flint Water Study team put together a standard water testing toolkit and posted a simple how-to video online that showed residents how they could accurately collect water samples from their own homes and then send them to the lab in Blacksburg, Virginia. It was an all-hands effort, according to Siddhartha Roy.
We would have like undergrad students, grad students in the lab on a weekend, putting boxes together, putting kits together.
The whole initiative hinged on whether the lab could get about 300 samples from homes in different neighborhoods across Flint. That's where Leanne and other concerned residents stepped in.
At this point, when we were actually going in, there were actual connections on the ground. This amazing group of citizens drove around town, you know, asking people if they would participate, and got a lot of people to say yes. They would spend 12, 14-hour days driving around town and handing out kits and making sure people understood what the proper procedure was. And these people were in touch with the local pastors in churches where people would be complaining about their brown water. Tapping into one of those groups gave us access to a lot more.
But what about concerns that these residents were too invested, too bound up in the politics of the problem, to help create an objective measure of lead in Flint's water supply?
They knew that relying on accurate information means that they have to follow the science to the word, and they did. So this amazing group of diverse people looking for answers made this happen.
According to Karen Cooper, citizen science is no less reliable than the work done by expert scientists.
I think we should trust citizen science for the same reasons we trust science. It's a process that has a rigorous systems in place to make sure that the data are good quality. I mean, we can look at this history of citizen science too and see that there's already lots of scientific discoveries that are thanks to citizen science, but we simply just assume that it was thanks to regular science. I mean, half of what we know about migratory birds and climate change comes from citizen science. There's a whole host of things that we just take for granted, things that we know that are actually from citizen science. So I think we can recognize that citizen science can really be just as rigorous as, you know, conventional science, and that ordinary people can easily have the skills needed to do their part.
According to Siddhartha Roy, the citizen scientists in Flint were eager to make sure their work was valid and that the lab got enough samples to make some solid claims about lead levels in the local water supply.
Not only did they follow everything to the letter in terms of the sampling, they made sure that if they missed something, they would let us know. So they were very thorough. They were people looking for answers, and they did the job better than most scientists.
The process that Leanne Walters recalls for collecting the samples is, in a word, meticulous.
You know, once we got the testing together, we had a group together, and we came up with guidelines on how to do this so that we could cover our bases, so that we wouldn't be discredited, so that they couldn't say that it wasn't done the right way. When people came in to get their kits, they were given a card to fill out with their information. They then sat down and they watched a video. We had somebody explaining the instructions on how to perform the test. So they had to fill out this information card. Once the card was filled out, they brought the card up to us. And when we would issue them a kit, put the kit number on there so we could keep track of who had what kit, who gave them the kit, the date and time they received their kit. With the kit, we gave them like a thank you card with information on where they could drop their kits off for further meetings. And we gave them people on the test team, the citizen scientist team, their phone names and phone numbers so that if they couldn't make it to one of the meetings, they could call one of us and we would come and pick up their kit for them. We were making them initial near the seam of the box, and then we taped the entire box up so that the homeowner and Virginia Tech would know that nobody but the homeowner had touched that sample, you know, to verify that the initials had to be under the tape. And then again, we would put down who received the kit back, the date, the time, and keep track of everything. This way, if it was called into question, we could say exactly how we did it.
The ground operation succeeded beyond everyone's expectations, including the scientists back at Virginia Tech.
And what they achieved was amazing because, you know, we were hoping to get a good idea of the entire city. So they made sure that there were enough people in every zip code. You know, we were hoping that, okay, we sent out 300. Maybe we'll get 75, you know, 25% back. But in 3 weeks, these amazing people who were looking for information, and they sent us more than 270. That's a 90% return rate.
For everyone back in Flint, failure was simply not an option.
No one had ever done anything like this before, so it was kind of learning to go type of a thing and, you know, figure out what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, yes, we had road bumps, but we addressed them as we came across them and moved forward and, you know, kept moving on it. That's like one of the greatest things out of this whole tragedy that has come out of it is all these people coming together, putting all differences aside and coming together to fight for what is right and to fight for what needs to be done. I mean, how many times do you see that? Flint has a really bad reputation for a lot of things, but look at what we've accomplished.
According to Karen Cooper, These accomplishments aren't limited to the case of polluted water in Flint. Science, she says, is a process available to any community worried about its local environment.
Ignorance is not bliss. So it goes for any person anywhere. They should have access to that scientific process so they can determine the quality of their water or their air or what they might be exposed to.
Back in Flint, the future is still uncertain. The health impacts of allowing so much lead to float through the city's water supply for so long will likely be felt for years to come. But for many residents, one thing does seem to be certain. Drive past a giant concrete block on a strip of road just minutes away from that Flint River, and you'll find 8 simple words spray-painted there for local officials to see. "You want our trust," they scream out in capital letters. "We want Virginia Tech." This is Philip Silva on The Nature of Cities.
You've been listening to This is the Nature of Cities podcast, produced by The Nature of Cities. Music by David Maddox. Copyright 2016, The Nature of Cities, all rights reserved. For more information about this or other Nature of Cities productions or publications, see thenatureofcities.com.